are listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org or search for Church of the Larger Fellowship in the iTunes Store.
Good morning. You've joined us for another episode of The View. Today we have Catherine Buck Clarenbach, who is an ordained UU minister and also an initiated priestess in the tradition of Stone Circle Wicca. We'll tell you a little bit more about her ministry when we move to that part of the show. But first, I'm Meg Riley in Minneapolis, where we have no dramatic weather at all. Michael Tino, how is it where you are?
Well, we have no dramatic weather here in Peekskill, New York. This is Michael Tino. We were expecting snowpocalypse round four yesterday. The schools were all closed, and there's no snow on my sidewalk, Meg, which I am not complaining about in the slightest.
And Asia Hauser, you're just back from finding our way home. So first of all, did you find your way home? Did you have any travel delays? And second of all, how are you and how was it?
Yes, I'm Asia Hauser in Seattle, and this year, finding our way home, the Religious Professionals of Color Retreat, sponsored by the Multicultural Growth and Witness Office of the UUA, was in Albuquerque. So, and I'm in Seattle, so we didn't have any snowpocalypses. And so I personally didn't have any flight delays. There were a few people that were delayed, almost a day and a half getting in from the East Coast. But so we had 120 participants, highest ever. When I first attended the beginning iteration of this gathering 10 years ago, it was 30 people, 8 religious educators, and 22 ministers and seminarians. And over the years, when Reverend Sophia Betancourt was leader of that office, she invited every religious professional of color who works for UU congregation. It was so powerful. We had Melvin Bray, who was part of Auburn Seminary, do some of the programming. Mark Hicks, Julica Herman de la Fuente did some of the programming, and it was powerful. And so my colleague, Jason Perkal, our director of finance and operations at East Shore, the church I'm currently serving, it was his first time. He is a man of Indian descent. And he said to me, he was explaining at our staff meeting his experience first time going, and he said, there was a lot of power in the room. And he said it was the most powerful worship. And he said it opened up for me a lot of possibilities of who we could be. So so I need to say last year's Finding Our Way Home was the seed. We are now talking earth today. The seed that was planted that led to the white supremacy teaching. Because when, you know, as the years went on and that gathering grew, I would kind of notice like which people were getting into positions of authority and power in our association. And then I'd hear stories of people having difficulty in congregations and not getting positions and just, you know, kind of connecting the dots. And so I need to give a shout out to UUA staff who are remarkable. Susan Frederick Gray came and was so authentic. She was present, generous of spirit. And so I really want to commend her. And Carrie McDonald was there the whole time. And he was same. I've known Carrie a long time and I respect and honor him. And the rest of the UUA staff, Janice Marie and Taquina Boston. And it was great. And Blue was there. There were Lena Gardner, executive director of Black Lives of UU, who just also planted the seed in me that possibilities. And so it felt like, you know, we are, I'm hoping, shifting in terms of opening our minds and hearts and our, I heard the phrase yesterday, opening our apertures to what is possible. So I don't know if you have any questions, but I really genuinely came home with such a full heart and hopeful. Oh, and several members of the Commission on Institutional Change were there and presented. And so that was really powerful as well.
You keep using the word powerful, which is great. I'm excited to hear like what leverage the power in the room thought might come out of the meeting. Were there any, I mean, last year, as you say, it really planted some seeds that led to, I think, very positive things. Not unbumpy, but very positive. But did it feel like things were Was it just kind of a, let's just catch a breath here and be or and get stronger to get back out? Or was there momentum in a direction or something?
Yeah, it's a good question. So it also, I would need to say the three co-presidents were there, Leon, Sophia, and Bill Singford. So that, so this time we, the group took the time to kind of do a design thinking kind of exercise. So between that and thinking like, what are the possibilities? So one idea that came out of it was, what if we started a, opened a UU based community center? And I mean, not think just church, right? What would that look like? What if we did an after school program? What if we did? And then so that was a powerful conversation in terms of, let's open our minds to, because sure, you know, we have the same conversation every year about what positions are open and what and how we have difficulty with white congregants. And but this really felt like, wait a minute, we can look at what how Blue is feeding folks who don't have the way CLF is, however geared towards Black UUs. So that was one conversation, the design thinking about what can this, what are the possibilities? And the conversation with the Commission on Institutional Change also invited folks to say, look, we need to not only tell our stories, but what are your ideas? How can we move forward to live out our values, live out our values more authentically in Unitarian Universalism? And so, and to what do we owe, or we're in service to, it was, I think, Reverend Natalie Fenimore who said something to the effect of like, her commitment is to Unitarian Universalism. And I learned that from her years ago, and I really hold that. And so that's what I'm, I would say it's genuinely looking toward, okay, there's been this ruckus, or as someone referred to it as the spring disruption. And now there's a lot of people thinking differently. And what does it look like to put that thinking differently into plan, into possibilities? And what would that look like? Does that make sense? I don't know if that answered your question.
Yeah, it's exciting. It's really exciting. So I realized I did not introduce Lori Stone Sertoski, who disappeared behind the chalice. I just wanted to thank Lori for being here doing tech today. Do you want to say what all you'll be doing and how people could interact with us, Lori?
Yeah, sure. So my name's Lori Stone Sertoski. I am in Indianapolis, Indiana currently, and I will be behind the chalice today running tech for this event. You can log into our YouTube channel to watch online and comment or send questions to the panel. And you can also interact with us on Twitter at CLFUU. That's our handle there. And you can always tweet yourself on the hashtag TheView, V-U-U, T-H-E-V-U-U. Thanks.
And when Lori says she's currently in Indianapolis, she means for this hour, and then she's moving to Phoenix. So safe travels to you, Lori.
Yes, and Pacific time, at least during daylight savings time, unite. The three of us are up very early. My body is already on Pacific time for some reason. I don't quite understand how the earth rhythms work, but they certainly have moved me into that time zone already.
Yeah, viewers should know that, you know, we span the gamut. Michael's been up for hours with a young child. I think Aisha and Catherine probably, yeah, they've got their coffee with them to be awake. And Lori and I right now are in the middle. So I just wanted to, before we do get into a conversation with Catherine, acknowledge that it's been a really horrific week in the world of anti-Blackness from so many directions. Sending out love and care to especially the Black people in the Austin area. But everyone, having lived through the sniper, I know how that kind of, you don't know where it's going to happen next and you don't know who it's going to happen to. I know how genuinely that disrupts everything, especially if you have young kids or otherwise. But yeah, especially the Black people in the Austin area. And they did get the guy, and apparently no one can figure out his motive. I think a white person targeting Black people, it's pretty clear to me what his motive was, but I wasn't there. Michael, you wanted to mention the Sacramento killing.
Yeah, and I just, you know, for those who are into the view behind the scenes, we chit chat before we get on the air, and I mentioned that the conversations around the man who did the bombings in Austin contrast very horrifically with the conversations around Stephen Clark's shooting in Sacramento. He's a young man who father of two who was shot in his backyard 20 times by the police holding a cell phone. And I've seen article after article try and paint him as like a neighborhood criminal to justify the fact that the cops shot him 20 times for holding a cell phone in his own backyard. And meantime, we're wondering what the motives of the man who bombed, sent bombs to black houses in Austin is. So it's my heart breaks again to have to say Black Lives Matter again and again and again and again. And so our prayers go to the folks in Sacramento too, to his family, but just to notice that the how white supremacy culture manifests itself in our national dialogue around these current events again and again and again. Doesn't matter.
Again and again, here locally in Minneapolis, the contrast is very vivid. Mike Freeman, our district attorney, stood up at a microphone and just lambasted the police officer who killed an unarmed woman, who's the police officer's now in jail. The police officer is black and the woman is white. And the police officer is Somali and the woman he shot is Australian. And the coverage of that shooting, this same Mike Freeman, when Jamar Clark, who was trying to help a friend who was in trouble, get into an ambulance and make sure she was okay, the same Mike Freeman stood up and instead of talking about the police officers who shot him in 6 seconds, lambasted Jamar Clark's character. So instead of talking about the police officers, the way that he talked about the police officer, the black police officer, he talked about the victim as if that was what we were all there to judge, as the behavior of the victim who was shot in 6 seconds. Yeah, it's so appallingly clear the role that not only the law enforcement, but the media that play in all of this by buying those narratives without challenging them. And I think, you know, that saying the whole damn system is guilty as hell just always comes to me. And I posted on Facebook, I've just been in such a visceral rage about this. And I know that's not helpful, you know, right? You've got to figure out how to move on to action. But the discrepancy is just so vivid. And so, yeah, it's everywhere. And I really hope that no matter where you are writing to your media about this, because all of the media, the white media, is complicit in this. And so I haven't yet, because I want to study the Star and Tribune coverage of Mike Freeman and really do another letter to the editor, lifting up, like, this is what you do to contribute to it. And we all do. We do it with social media. We do it with every venue that we have. We either perpetuate the white supremacist narrative or the other. Now, what do you guys think about this? There's this new thing, like, where white people are all saying, like, I'm going to interrupt white supremacy. And a lot of white people, not only UUs, but in some other denominations, are kind of taking a public vow to do that. Michael, I'm curious, have you done that?
I have. I will again and again. I mean, I don't think anyone should be surprised that I'm willing to take public vows to interrupt white supremacy culture in my faith and in my community. You know, I think it's lovely. And, you know, the rubber meets the road when we held ourselves accountable to those public vows, right? So who's going to hold me accountable?
Right. Yeah. Lori just said the hashtag is refuse to be complicit.
And I'm okay if other white people hold me accountable to that public vow. I don't think it should be Unitarian Universalists of color who need to hold me accountable for my vow to interrupt and to disrupt white supremacy culture and Unitarian Universalism. And I fear that that's what it winds up being. too often.
Yeah, I actually didn't do it because I thought, if I don't embody this, what is the point of saying that I do? I wasn't against it. I just thought, is this like wearing a safety pin? You know, like I'm one of the good guys. I mean, I just, I feel like the deeper I get into understanding white supremacy, the more implicated in it I am. It's not like the deeper I understand it, the more I go, those people, it's like, no, this is so deeply in me that taking public vows, I mean, I'm not opposed to it, but I felt uncomfortable because I thought either I'm already doing that or I'm not, you know, or probably both every day. Aisha, your turn.
Yeah, because so one of the folks in the congregation where I am now posted it on our closed Facebook page. And I will say it really created a helpful conversation. So to me, the concepts of what you're, where you are, Meg, and the taking a stand aren't mutually exclusive. And I'd rather people do that than not, because there are still people arguing against the words white supremacy culture. And I'm like, we're now arguing the earth is flat. Like, come on, folks. Like, I don't. So to me, however, it's yes. And that don't stop it, the hashtag, and continue to take the invitation to understand. I'm part of white supremacy culture. We're all people of color, black people. There's either victims of white supremacy culture or those who are outright perpetrators or those who are complicit. I mean, we could kind of, if we need to simplify it. So to me, I actually, and the article is by Alex Capitan, and I thought it was an outstanding article, and it was lifting up two faiths, Unitarian Universalism and Metropolitan Community Church. And I apologize if I got that wrong, it's MCC, that are grappling with white supremacy culture within liberal faiths. And so the article itself was helpful, I felt. And what, so I refuse to be complicit, then what? What are you looking at? What are folks willing to break down and say, what is it in this system? How are you doing leadership, right? There are still white UU minister, male ministers who preach, well, poor me, I'll never get chosen for a leadership position. Poor me, I'm now aggrieved and now not the, I mean, it's funny, but it's not. So it's almost like in the UUMA, I would invite my friends who are in the UUMA, all of, you know, who are colleagues, say, talk to your colleagues and say, hey, friend, white male who's feeling aggrieved and put upon and oppressed. Are you really oppressed? Really? So, you know, this is what I would invite you all to do, because I can't do that. I can't even do that with a lot of white people. So let alone, I mean, I can't do it with white male ministers who want me off the planet, probably some of them. So anyway.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I hope I'm doing that, but okay. I mean, I'll take it. I'll take a vow. It just,
you are
so easy to say, like so easy to say, so hard to do. Catherine, have you gotten into that? Refuse to be complicit?
I did not take the vow, or have not at this point, for exactly the reasons you mentioned, Meg. I feel like the more I learn about white supremacy culture, the more complicit I feel in it, just by the patterns I have learned, the ways I have learned to lead and collaborate and be in relationship. And I think of other vows that we take in our lives, not knowing where they're going to lead us. So I'm still sort of discerning. I want to be held accountable. And that's the appeal of taking the vow for me, which Michael mentioned, that it's an invitation for people to say, you have said you're not going to be complicit in this. Here's how you're being complicit in it. And to continue the conversation at a deeper level. So I think I am inclined to do it, but I haven't to this point.
Yeah. Well, this is a good conversation. It makes me revisit it, because you know how things come by. Things come by on Facebook. Lori from Behind the Chalice is saying there's an education component as well. So I haven't really looked deeply into what it is. I certainly feel like with the energy that I have in my life, this is part of being, trying to be human. understanding the ways that I am complicit. And Catherine, you put that really well. So let's talk about your ministry, Catherine. You were a priestess before you went to seminary.
Yes.
So I'm really curious. And one more group we're going to do a shout out to is all the people at the MFC, the people running and traveling to it, their friends, their family, everybody who's wrestling with bad weather on top of all the other stress. We send you our love and good wishes. So you did that. You did that whole MFC thing, but first you got ordained as a priestess. So I'd love to hear why you decided to do both and what it was like to do both, how it was similar and different. And
sure. Well, one thing I should say is that I am an initiated priestess. We don't, in my tradition, talk about ordination.
Okay.
It's a different system.
Yeah.
So, and I don't want to, you know, it's sort of like talking about our UU formation process. You don't want to overcomplicate it when you're trying to explain it. But I was in training with folks in the Stone Circle Wicca tradition in Southern Pennsylvania at Four Quarters Interfaith Sanctuary there are 3 degrees. And for my first degree, I studied for about 1.5 years. For my second degree, I was in mentorship for 2 years. And for my third degree, I was in mentorship for a little over 1 year. And so it was genuinely a rigorous process of learning. And in our tradition, we move from, in the beginning, learning how to make ritual and ceremony for other people, learning how to live a spirituality that is related to the seasons. And then we move into this kind of journey into the underworld, second degree, that is about really confronting your own shadows and dealing with some of that internal work that can be just really scary and lonely at times. And then the third degree sort of commission is to be of service and to vow to be of service to your community as a priest or priestess, or as folks are now saying, a priestex, which is a word that I really like, vowing to be of service in your community in perpetuity. So I was doing that work. I was involved at Four Quarters for 12 years. And so for much of that time, I was involved with Stone Circle Wicca. And now I wrote some of the original first degree curricula that we used when we formalized our classes. And now some 300 people have gone through that process at that place. And I feel like for a pagan institution, that's really a lot of people. It's really a lot of people. So.
The words pagan institution are kind of
it's a little
organized religion applied to UUism. So were you also identifying as a UU during that time? Or
I sort of came back to Unitarian Universalism in the middle of that time. I joined All Souls DC in the middle of that time and realized that Unitarian Universalism was a place where my constant urge to live into what I describe as a Christian adjacent pagan identity could be lived out fully. And while there's sometimes it feels a little squished around the edges, there were spaces and there was room for me to do some good work and to reconnect with a faith that had been important to me back in the 90s when I belonged to Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. So that's sort of how that went. And I was then ordained only in 2015. So I started seminary in late 2010.
So what made you want to do both? What made you want to be also an ordained UU minister?
I think, partly, honestly, it was knowing other ministers. it was meeting ministers and feeling this kind of like resonance, like a bell, you know, that I felt so keenly the desire to continue spiritual leadership and spiritual engagement in a faith context that was sometimes multi-faith, sometimes not exactly multi-faith. I really appreciate some of the ambiguity and mixed upness of many of the theologies in our Unitarian Universalist world, that sometimes I'm frustrated by them and sometimes I love them, and I nearly always really appreciate the conversations that arise when people start to try to articulate them. And as I said, I've never wanted to repudiate the work that I have done as a priestess and the kind of ceremony and the kind of ritual that I have done in that context. But I also felt this call to greater engagement with this Christian adjacency that I experienced as well. I don't know if that's clear, but it's life, so it's a little complicated. But Aisha, you have a question.
Yeah, I was curious about how you chose a seminary that would, I would imagine, complement what you were already coming in with, because it sounds like such a rich, I'm like, huh, I never considered becoming an initiated priestess. I'm not a Wiccan at all, but it sounds so rich. And so I wonder, so A, how did you choose a seminary? And through your process, were there times where you felt there were things that were either at odds with what you were already coming in with or complemented?
That's a great question. That's a great question. I really wanted to go to a Christian seminary. It was very important to me. So I went to Wesley in DC, which is a Methodist seminary. I also wanted to go to a seminary that had many more people of color than I had seen in other seminaries I visited, and had greater socioeconomic diversity than I had seen at some seminaries I had visited. And, you know, I was raised Roman Catholic, and despite what some folks might see, the leap from Roman Catholicism to Wicca is not a very big leap. It's really not. But Protestantism is the ascendant religion or set of religions in this culture that we're in. And I really felt like I needed to engage and learn and become close and in relationship with people who were different from me in those ways. So not only was it Christian, but it was Protestant Christianity, which was, you know, new to me. And as far as there being conflicts, I mean, certainly there were not always times when I felt comfortable saying, well, you know, as a sort of bi-religious or hyphenated religious person, I think this. You know, there were times I didn't always speak up and say, identify in a class of 70 people how my pagan experiences were informing what I was doing. In smaller groups, I certainly did, you know, where I was in closer relationship with folks. But for the most part, I had a tremendous experience in seminary. I loved seminary. And my father was a scholar who taught the Bible as literature, though he did not identify as a Christian himself. And so I already had that kind of background. And that engagement with text and history and liturgy and music and that kind of
thing. Is that why you wanted a Christian seminary?
In part, because I think that biblical literacy is really important for our UU folks, our UU religious professionals. And many of us don't have it. And I wanted to make sure that I was grounded in that, that I wasn't only, I wanted to be able to sit at a table at a ministerium and be taken seriously and also be able to bring this breadth of who I was. Because Christianity is really important to me and to my history, even though I don't identify as Christian, but rather as Christian adjacent.
That's really interesting, the Christian adjacent. And, you know, I was thinking about the Catholicism. I'm part of a new moon, full moon group here. Mm-hmm. The other night, the full moon was on St. Patrick's Day. So everyone started telling their Catholic school stories. And all of a sudden I said, is it a UU congregation? I said, was everyone here but me raised Catholic? And the woman in the group was like, yep. Uh-huh. And I think it's because they're both really sacramental, you know, which is really different from the word-oriented nature of Protestantism, which right. is like on steroids in Unitarian Universalism. So yes. I'm curious how that kind of, and you're a writer, among other things that you do, but how that relationship to the word and relationship to sacrament, you know, dance together for you in your ministry.
Oh my gosh, that is a beautiful question. And the first time I ever went to All Souls in DC, you know, that church is built on the original design of St. Martin in the Fields in England. So you go in and it's got, you know, the aisles and the columns and the place where the cross would be behind the chancel and this giant pulpit in the middle and this little table, little altar table down below. And so it was a complete reversal from my historical experience of what the inside of a church would look like. Because as a Roman Catholic, the altar is the center of sacramental life, right? So I really am somebody who tries to bring in as much of the senses as possible when I am able to help create services with folks. I'm collaborating on an Easter service for this year, and we're doing not just a regular sermon sandwich kind of ceremony, but involving some other aspects of touch and blessing and engagement with the body. And I think that's one of the things that earth-centered or pagan traditions can really, can and have really brought into Unitarian Universalism. Oh, Aisha's asking what congregation is doing this. It's West Hills in Portland, Oregon. West Hills UU Fellowship.
Are there congregations that you know of that bring in more of the earth ritual? I mean, I came into ministry from not being initiated anywhere, but mm-hmm. doing a lot of ritual with friends. And I started out as a religious educator doing the four mm-hmm. directions with the kids and everything. And then at some point I went, oh, this is what they think Unitarian Universalism is. I should stop. You know,
right?
And so I changed it, did the rainbow path with our principles, you know, mm-hmm. with still candles, but you know, but they loved the directions because they held them, you know.
Right.
And so I just wonder, are there churches where they wouldn't say, "Oh, I need"? No one told me that. I censored myself on that. But are there
right.
congregations that are doing
well? Oh, gosh, that's such a hard question, and I think it's very important to be kind. But I also need to say, I think in many of our congregations, earth-centered folks, white folks in particular, engage in an awful lot of, I'll have some of this, and I'll have some of that, and I'll have some of this over here, cultural appropriation in public ceremony that is irresponsible and embarrassing to me. And so I think there are many congregations where folks are nervous about having too much of an earth-centered identity. It's kind of like churches where people are nervous about being known as the gay church in town. You don't want to be the pagan church in town either. But there are lots of congregations. I mean, the San Diego congregation has the big one, has a very, very well attended winter solstice celebration every year. The Frederick, Maryland congregation has a cups chapter that is swelling beyond the walls of the congregation. They had a pagan pride day this past year that hundreds and hundreds of people came to in Frederick, Maryland, which is in a pretty rural area. I mean, it's in the exurbs of DC, you know. Few people commute from that far, but it's pretty exciting.
Can I jump in? Because our congregation has a family that is the mom especially identifies as pagan, and they actually lead 4 times a year outside of Sunday morning, the solstice. And the winter one is the most popular. We have a soup potluck every year. And then there's summer, fall. I know I'm saying the name, but the four, and they're done when they happen. In other words, not just, again, not the fall, but, and they're pretty, they're rich and they're well attended. And they are led by someone who identifies in an earth-centered pagan faith, not like you said, because I agree, I've seen it's kind of cringeworthy when folks kind of smatter and it's still misappropriation. I mean, just because it's not, I mean, sometimes misappropriation is clear when it's Native American or indigenous cultures or, but for some reason we think we could take from the pagans and it's perfectly acceptable and it's not. So I appreciate you lifting that up as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think it's also difficult because paganism, as it is practiced now, or as it's sometimes called, neo-paganism, right, is very young. Even though we hearken back to some things that are known about cultures at other times, and we try to connect with a spirituality that's seasonal, right, that's based on where we are and who we are in a place on a land. And I think that, for me, what we called at Four Quarters psycho-emotive transformational ritual, you know, you users are not the only ones who can have a mouthful of stuff, right? but we called it that really transformative ritual. And ritual that identifies, I am in this place. And that's why the four directions are important, because the four elements identify sort of, who am I? What am I made of? What is this universe made of? How can we metaphorically, mythically talk about this? And then the four directions say, here's where I am in space, and here's where I am in the universe. And so those correspondences work together.
What does psycho-emotive mean? I don't know.
Yeah. My friend Jonathan White, who was a working partner of mine in Stone Circle Wicca for years, I think is the one who came up with that language. It means that when you leave a service or a ceremony or a ritual or however you want to talk about it, depending what kind of thing it is, you are changed on a psychological level, that there is change happening inside of you. It's not purely aesthetic. It's not purely intellectual. I mean, really, we would probably say embodied psycho-emotive transformative ritual. But it's getting a little, you know, much. So I think ritual isn't worth much to me if it doesn't engage the whole self. And I also want to say something that's really important. We almost only ever had multi-generational worship, you know, all the time. Like it was outside. There were always people of all ages there. And it was just part of our way of doing things. And again, having grown up Roman Catholic, the idea of not going to Mass with my family would have been totally foreign. So then coming into Unitarian Universalism and going to congregations where I didn't see kids in services, or if I did, I saw them only for part of services, was very different for me. That was a very different experience.
So I'm fascinated by this and excited to hear you talk about these kinds of rituals. And so there are sort of two ways I can go right now. And so I'm going to go the positive way, which is I'm wondering how what you're talking about, the kinds of psycho-emotive embodied ritual practices, can help pull Unitarian Universalism into a place where we worship as whole beings. Because it's my experience, and maybe yours differs, that many Unitarian Universalist communities, and especially in worship, we tend to be, you know, floating brains. I mean, not even like faces around the brains. We're floating brains, and our worship is geared towards the intellectual, often at the exclusion of psychological, emotional, embodied, and all these other dimensions of who we are as beings. So I'm wondering, someone who does both this whole person ritual, and as someone who is a Unitarian Universalist minister, how you've experienced, I guess, pointing us in a different direction or pulling our faith into a more whole place.
Yeah. One thing that I would say is that I think our youth know a lot of this instinctively. I hear from youth who have had experiences with each other building rituals for and with each other, that then they go, as they grow and they come back into a Unitarian Universalist context, maybe after some time away, and they're like, what is this? What happened? Where is the dancing that I experienced when I was with other youth? And so, I mean, that's maybe me going to the negative aspect, right? That as adults, we often, UU adults, we often are missing some of that. But one piece I would say is there is this cohort of folks among us, our youth, who already know how important this is. The other thing I would say is that I think folks who are interested in this kind of work can take a risk and move when music is playing, right? You know, like, that's such a simple thing. But it's something that I think about a lot, because I always do it. When music is playing, when we're singing, I am expressive with my body, she said, waving her hands all around. And that sometimes gives other people the freedom to be in their bodies. I also think that we can move from the head into the heart and belly sort of knowing centers as in a transitional way, by as ministers and other religious professionals preaching and teaching, intellectually saying the body is important, we are embodied people, and then moving from that into practices, you know, there are lots of congregations that do meditation as part of their service, that do, that use bells or other ways of engaging the senses a little bit. We're not wholly from the neck up. And I think sometimes I accuse us of being only from the neck up, sometimes a little too harshly. Because as I preach around in the Pacific Northwest, one of the things that I've seen is that folks have a hunger for this fuller experience.
Hi. Yes, thank you for all of that. And I wonder if the unintended consequence of such an intellectualized, what I'm going to call the UUK ordained priestly class, and the process of our ordination has created kind of folks who lead worship that are evil, either don't know how to connect the body embodiment rituals. And I also want to connect it to the, for some, the either discomfort or unwillingness to do, to have more multi-generational worship. Because I actually had a UU minister say to me, I'm child phobic. And you know, that wouldn't be okay to say about any other group of people. You would not jokingly say I'm homophobic or jokingly say, right, I really don't like to be around Black people. I mean, that's not, but we're okay saying, I'm not comfortable around children. I'm child phobic. Mm-hmm. And what is it about when we're together, you know, children are squirmy, if we're trying to meditate in a child. I mean, I've had people say, I'm really a proponent of multi-generational worship because I grew up Arab and everything we did was multi-generational. And so to me, it's like when somebody's meditating and they hear a crying baby, like, well, that's distracting. Well, why are you focusing on that? Why aren't you happy that we have life in this congregation?
That's right. That's right. And meditation in a congregational communal context, for my money, is not just about settling into your own silence. It's about settling into the experience of the gathered assembly, you know? So that's something that I think is really important. There are times, I think, when there are topics that parents may want to know are being preached on or talked about, so that they can make decisions about how to bring their children into that space or to talk with their children about what's happening. And that's perfectly appropriate and good. But I do think that one of the great things about some of the sixth source work that we do sometimes is that we can more easily engage children in a way, and youth in a way that people are less uncomfortable with. If they know they're going to a winter solstice celebration and the kids process in with, you know, bells and ribbons and stuff, or if you're having a Beltane celebration around May 1st and you're going to do a maypole and it's sort of chaotic and funny and people are dancing and trying to weave the maypole and it's a big mess, it's clear that it's okay because it's kind of built in to that system. So I think that's part of speaking to your earlier question, Michael. One thing is that we can be a little less perfectionistic about how and what we expect and what perfection or excellence in worship looks like.
Yeah, and it seems like if we thought that excellence meant that people were spiritually, psychologically, emotionally, physically transformed by our gathering together, it would look and sound and feel different.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, I really feel that in my heart as you're saying that. Like, I really feel that in my body. Speaking of bodies, I really am experiencing that in my body. If we had, as Unitarian Universalists, more of an expectation that we would come together in order to be changed, that we came together in order to become, as communities and individuals, changed in the rest of our lives, then our worship might look really different. If we didn't come just to be confirmed or affirmed in what we already believe and know.
Yeah, that would be different. It'd be really different. I'm curious, you know, Paul Tillich came back from Germany, Nazi Germany, and said that he saw in UU churches a lot of the kind of naturalistic framing, and that's what a lot of the Nazis were grounded in the earth. We're doing earth-centered worship. And he said, how would you know if you went into a UU congregation that they didn't support Nazis? So that's a really dramatic way to ask. How can you tell in earth-centered spirituality that there's a human element at working towards justice? How does that come into the cosmology of the earth?
Right. I think one of the things that's really important to mention is that in Unitarian Universalism, particularly, but in the whole pagan movement, the women's movement of the late 60s, 70s, and 80s was absolutely instrumental and remains instrumental in many pagan understandings of the world and of cosmology. In our tradition, we talk about the divine who is one and many, male, female, both, and neither. I don't know if that would make us not Nazis, but I think that there are times when folks who identify as UU earth religious or pagan folks need to say and need to take the lead in environmental justice that is not simply conservationism, that is not simply about national parks, but also is about bringing people together around the human elements of environmental concerns, like food deserts and the undue burden on people of color and people in poverty due to environmental concerns. I mean, I think the environment is where a lot of pagan UUs go, and that makes perfect sense. But I think there's also a split because many pagan UUs are also some of our most apolitical people, in my experience. I see a question that is being hidden.
Sorry, I was asking if you would you say that paganism is white-centered? And I honestly don't know.
Well, I would say this. I have had the good fortune to be graciously invited and welcomed into a community of people who practice African diaspora religions, not as an initiate, not as a member of that community, but as a welcomed guest. And I've spoken with some of those folks and said, so how do you feel about paganism, this idea of paganism, and are African diaspora religions pagan? Well, they're very earth-centered. They share concern with ancestral veneration that I have in my tradition. That's a discussion that's sort of happening in the earth-centered world that some folks identify as pagan and some don't. Some folks see paganism as a European experience, and other people don't. But I would say that if of organized pagan organizations in the United States, they're very, very white. So yes, I would say that.
Is there an awareness of things like cultural misappropriation in the general leadership, would you say?
It's definitely a conversation. It's definitely a conversation that is happening publicly and sometimes with great vigor and ardor. So there is an awareness of the difficulties of cultural appropriation and what does it mean to use a practice that, you know, for example, for years, I used the burning of white sage to clear spaces. And I learned it in a pagan context from lots of people who did that with no knowledge or understanding of the background of indigenous people's use of white sage, where it came from, how it grows, where you get it, why it's important, you know. So, and that's something I just recently wrote a blog series on, being a cultural pillager, a cultural tourist, or a cultural guest. On thewayoftheriver.com, which is my ministerial website. And I talk about, you know, I own that there's a lot of pagan tradition that is constantly having to be revisited. Is this something that is from a living tradition that is, that we're ripping off? Is this something that is a creative thing, a new thing, something that we're birthing as a creative ritual tradition, or, you know, what are we doing? And so I think those conversations, particularly in leadership, are happening. And they're happening, you know, in CUPS, for sure. You know, the Covenant of Unitarian Universalist Pagans has tried to have some important conversations about that over the years.
And how would people find CUPS if they wanted to see more about Unitarian Universalist Paganism?
One of the ways to find CUPS is to look on Facebook. There is a very, very active CUPS Facebook community page, or group, I should say. The group page thing is so confusing. And many of my blog posts appear there, so I'm a fan of that page. And some congregations, of course, have CUPS groups. And one could ask one's minister, do we have one? And who should I talk to? Or if you don't have a CUPS group, often the minister knows folks who are earth-centered in the congregation who may want to get together and eventually perhaps be incorporated as a CUPS group, or not, but perhaps.
Well, thanks so much for being here. It's really interesting journey that you've had, and I think it's fascinating that as place centered and body centered as you've described your path, you're mostly doing ministry online now.
Yeah,
kind of interesting and one could say ironic, but I don't know. So, but that's working for you.
Yeah. It certainly is. I mean, I love the fact that I get to preach regularly and help what I call build ceremony or plan services with other people. But I do, I mean, I have folks that I work with in Thailand and in South Africa, and I do spiritual accompaniment or spiritual direction, as some people call it, from a UU place, though many of my clients are from lots of different traditions or none. So it is, in a way it's ironic that I'm doing that, but it's also how one of the ways that we connect with each other. And connection is, I think, what is most deeply important, as you all know from CLF and the ways that you try to reach out and connect with other folks.
Indeed. And Lori is reminding me that CLF does have a CUPS group. We affiliated, and that's a Facebook group. So, and she's posting all of those, as well as Catherine's contact information, over at the Facebook page of the Church of the Larger Fellowship. So thank you so much for being here, Catherine.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Possessions here next week, but it'll be, oh.
Doug.
Yeah. Do you want to say something about him?
Doug Muter, who is a writer for UU World, will be on next week, and he'll talk about his most recent article, or we will ask him about all of his articles. But the one I'm most interested in is the one when he had written about being a racist himself. He's a white man, and the pushback he got, and the people were angry at him for self-identifying as a racist. So it'll be a rich conversation, is my guess.
Well, maybe people will be mad at me for what I said earlier in the show today. Mad at Catherine. Thank you so much for being here. It's always a joy, and be kind to yourselves and each other.
This has been an episode of The View. If you would like to learn more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.